The Fourth District Appellate Court of the State of Illinois has reconvened. The Honorable Thomas M. Harris presiding.
Good afternoon. The first case this afternoon is case number 4-24-1039, People versus Wallace Braxton. Could we have appearances first for the appellant?
Good afternoon, Your Honors. I'm Assistant Appellate Defender Matthew Daniels, and I represent the appellant, Wallace Braxton.
Okay, thank you. And for the appellee?
Good afternoon, Your Honors. Adam Rodriguez for the people.
Thank you. Mr. Daniels, you may proceed with your argument.
Thank you. Good afternoon, Your Honors and counsel. May it please the court. Your Honors, the judgment of the trial court should be reversed for two main reasons. First, plea counsel's errors during the 2023 sentencing hearing and the 2024 remand proceedings require further remand. And second, the trial court's 10-year extended term sentence for aggravated driving while license revoked was excessive. My plan for today is to focus most of my attention on issue one and then touch briefly on issue two, but I'll be happy to answer any questions about either of the issues that the court may have. So, turning to our first issue, plea counsel's errors require remand for further proceedings here. And this issue seeks relief via two different legal theories that share a common factual thread. The two legal theories are Rule 604D noncompliance and ineffective assistance of plea counsel. The common thread that runs through these claims is that the trial court improperly imposed a mandatory consecutive sentence at the 2023 sentencing hearing based on Mr. Braxton committing the offense in this case while he was on pretrial release for a pending felony in McLean County. I'll address the 604D noncompliance first. During the remand proceedings, counsel did file a facially valid 604D certificate, but the record rebuts the presumption of compliance that was created by that certificate because the record shows the counsel failed to make all necessary amendments to the post-plea motion. Specifically, the record shows that counsel failed to make the amendment to allege that the trial court erred at sentencing by imposing that mandatory consecutive sentence. That was a necessary amendment. Counsel recognized that the mandatory consecutive sentencing claim was necessary. That's why he got a continuance on remand to amend the motion to add the claim. The problem is that he never followed through.
Do
And
we
that
know why he didn't?
we don't, Your Honor. And at any rate, that failure to amend resulted in waiver of the mandatory consecutive sentencing claim in this appeal. So because counsel failed to make this necessary amendment, the record rebuts the presumption of strict compliance that was created by the certificate, and further remand is needed for new post-plea proceedings. We recognize.
Right on that one point, while you're there, I had a question. Can this issue even be waived? I mean, isn't there, how can it be waived? Isn't it essential that a defendant be advised of his right to elect, which law to be sentenced under if there's been a change prior to his being sentenced?
Your Honor, I don't know the exact answer to your question. I certainly understand the logic of it. To be frank, the way we did frame this was looking at it through the lens that even if we take 604D's plain text and Ratliff at its face, that the injury here is that he can't raise that substantive claim of error in this appeal. And that's why we've sought relief for further proceedings below. Because of it, because I unless I'm missing something as far as there this being the sort of right that can't be waived, I think at a minimum it would still allow for remand through either the lens of 604D noncompliance or ineffective assistance. So with that in mind, since we've established that there was 604D noncompliance here, further remand is required, and we recognize that that would be a second remand, and it is warranted here because this is not a case where the People versus Shirley exception applies. And that's because Mr. Braxton has never received a full and fair hearing on the mandatory consecutive sentencing claim. What Shirley and the cases from this court that have applied Shirley have in common is that in all of those cases, the defendants there had their all of their claims adjudicated. And that didn't happen here because Mr. Braxton's mandatory consecutive sentencing claim was not, he didn't get a full and fair hearing on that claim. It certainly didn't get raised in the 2023 post-plea proceedings. And during the 2024 remand proceedings, plea counsel never followed through to actually make that amendment. I recognize that he makes a passing reference to the claim during oral argument on the motion on remand, but it's literally just 10 words that he tacked on in sort of a half-hearted manner at the end of an otherwise terse argument. And that isn't sufficient to be a full and fair hearing where he didn't cite any authority, he didn't develop that argument at all. What that motion hearing really was an empty formality that served no purpose beyond clearing a procedural hurdle to send the case back to this court. And that's the textbook example of one surely does not apply. And this court's recognized that textbook example in cases like Guth and Monroe and Bruce. So turning to the ineffective assistance of plea counsel claims, again, this is the underlying common thread is this mandatory consecutive sentencing issue. So what we've raised on appeal here are two separate ineffective assistance claims, one that occurred at the 2023 sentencing hearing and one that occurred at the 2024 remand proceedings. What I'm planning to do is discuss the deficient performance prongs for each of those two claims first, then circle back to the prejudice prong. So starting with the 2023 sentencing hearing, the deficient performance there was that counsel misapprehended the law regarding mandatory consecutive sentencing. And to sort of set the table with the relevant background facts and law for that claim, keep in mind that when Mr. Braxton committed this offense in April of 2021, he was on pretrial release for a felony in McLean County. And at that time, that fact pattern would have triggered mandatory consecutive sentencing under the Code of Corrections. But before Mr. Braxton's sentencing date in this case, the legislature amended the Code of Corrections and made that fact pattern a grounds for permissive consecutive sentence and eliminated the mandatory consecutive sentencing trigger. And that change in the law took effect about 5 months before Mr. Braxton was sentenced in 2023. Nevertheless, at the actual sentencing hearing, the state insisted that that fact pattern continued to trigger mandatory consecutive sentencing, and plea counsel acquiesced in that understanding of the law. And that's what demonstrates the misapprehension of the law, which gives rise to the deficient performance there. Now, regarding that particular piece of deficient performance, the state doesn't address the 2023 deficient performance at all in its brief and thus forfeits any response to it. Turning to the 2024 remand proceedings, there, the deficient performance is simply counsel's failure to make that amendment to include the necessary to add the mandatory consecutive sentencing claim to the post-plea motion. And he got that continuance on remand specifically to add that specific claim, and then he never made the amendments. And there can't be any reasonable trial strategy that would excuse that failure. On appeal, the state tries to sidestep this deficient performance in two ways, and both of them fail. First, the state argues that there's no deficient performance because the mandatory consecutive sentencing claim was meritless. So if it had been added to the motion, it wouldn't have gone anywhere anyway. And that's incorrect. And this gets to what Justice Zinoff was alluding to a few minutes ago. At the time of the sentencing hearing in 2023, the law had already changed regarding mandatory consecutive sentencing and making this fact pattern permissive. So Mr. Braxton did have the right to elect between the old law and new law regarding consecutive sentencing. He was deprived of that opportunity to elect. The court certainly didn't advise him of that right to elect. And there's no record evidence that he expressly waived that right that no one ever advised him of. And so that was a violation of his due process rights. And as a consequence of that due process deprivation, based on that misapprehension of the law that both the lawyers and the judge, sentencing judge, had in 2023, the trial court imposed a mandatory consecutive sentence. So, because of that due process violation that prejudiced Mr. Braxton, his post-plea mandatory consecutive sentencing claim would have prevailed had counsel simply actually followed through in making that amendment and meaningfully litigating it on remand. Now, the second way the state tries to sidestep this deficient performance is by arguing that the trial courts didn't actually impose a mandatory consecutive sentence and imposed a permissive consecutive sentence instead. And that's clearly rebutted by the record. The clearest record evidence that this was a mandatory consecutive sentence are the trial court's own words on remand on the court date where it granted that motion for a continuance for counsel to make the amendment to the motion to include this mandatory consecutive claim. And in granting that continuance, what the trial court said in so many words was that I'm granting this motion because back in 2023, we were all still under the impression that the old law was in effect. And I thought I had to impose a mandatory consecutive sentence because of this fact pattern. That should begin and end any dispute about whether this was a mandatory consecutive sentence. So, turning now to the Strickland prejudice here, Mr. Braxton was prejudiced by plea counsel's deficient performance. And that's because this case is like People versus Mescal. In Mescal, like here, the appeal involved an ineffective assistance claim alleging that sentencing counsel misapprehended the law of mandatory consecutive sentencing. And what Mescal held was that where sentencing counsel's misapprehension of mandatory consecutive sentencing law resulted in the trial court failing to exercise any discretion in imposing consecutive sentences, then Strickland's prejudice is satisfied. And that's precisely what we have here. And we know that again from what the trial court said on remand in granting that continuance, where he talks about the fact that he thought he had to impose consecutive sentences here. So, because we have established both deficient performance and prejudice, we've established ineffective assistance. And the relief Mr. Braxton would be entitled to would be remand for further proceedings. The one wrinkle that I will flag, though, regarding the relief for the ineffective assistance claim is that the remand relief would not be identical for these two claims simply because of the different procedural postures in which the two separate errors occurred. So, since the first error that I talked about at the 2023 sentencing hearing happened at sentencing, that ineffective assistance claim would give rise to remand for a new sentencing hearing. Whereas, since the failure to amend on remand happened during post-plea proceedings, the relief that he would be entitled to would be remand for further post-plea proceedings. So, for either of those two sort of big reasons, whether it's 604D noncompliance or ineffective assistance, plea counsel's errors below give rise to reversible error that require this court to send the case back for further proceedings. So I want to briefly address our second issue as well, and that's the excessive sentencing claim. The trial court's 10-year extended term sentence here was excessive. And our briefs set forth in detail the reasons why that's so. And what I'd like to focus on today is how this case is a lot like People versus Allen, which we discussed in our briefs. Both of those cases involve defendants with very extensive criminal histories who were sentenced in the context of cases where the applicable sentencing rules created by the legislature expressly took into account much of each defendant's criminal history. In Allen, it was the provision in the Code of Corrections that made him exable by background. Here we have two different sort of statutory rules that come into play. One is within the driving while license revoke statute itself. By virtue of the fact that Mr. Braxton has committed this offense more than two dozen times, that elevated this offense from its base level Class A felony all the way up to a class or Class A misdemeanor, all the way up to a Class 2 felony. Layer on top of that his criminal history also made him extended term sentencing eligible. And what Allen teaches is that in situations like this, where the sentencing rules that the legislature have created account for the aggravation that's inherent in the defendant's recidivism, the question on review when analyzing an excessive sentencing claim is how much weight does the defendant's criminal history carry as additional aggravation that the sentencing rules don't already account for? And here, there's not enough residual aggravation in Mr. Braxton's criminal history that the elevation of the class of the offense from a Class A misdemeanor to a Class 2 felony hasn't already been accounted for, coupled with the fact that he's extended term eligible by background. So it's another way of saying that there was an abuse of discretion here because the trial court overestimated the residual aggravation that Mr. Braxton's criminal history carried. And so as a result, that 10-year sentence is not supported by the aggravating factors the trial court found, because beyond criminal history, the only other aggravating factor the trial court found here was general deterrence. And that on its own, or coupled with the criminal residual aggravation from the criminal history, isn't enough to get him up to a 10-year sentence. And so that makes it manifestly disproportionate to the seriousness of the offense, much like in Allen. And I'll point out that Allen, which we discussed in our brief, both of our briefs, is a case the state did not directly respond to in its brief, and so they forfeited any opportunity to respond to it here. But what we're asking for in issue two is, like in Allen, for this court to exercise its Supreme Court Rule 615b4 authority to modify Mr. Braxton's sentence to a term of years that is both proportionate to the seriousness of the offense, as well as the aggravation and mitigation that were presented at the sentencing hearing. So, if there are no other questions from the court, we would ask that this court reverse the judgment of the trial court.
All right, thank you, Mr. Daniels. You'll have time in rebuttal. Mr. Rodriguez, you may proceed.
Thank you, Your Honor. Once again, good afternoon, Your Honors, counsel, and may it please the court. A second remand for compliance with Rule 604D is not required, where defendant both forfeited and waived his claim of sentencing error, and the record rebuts the presumption of compliance, and the record, excuse me, does not rebut the presumption of compliance arising from the filing of the Rule 604D certificate. In this case, remand for further compliance with Rule 604D is not required where a defendant was afforded a full and fair second opportunity to present a motion to reconsider sentence, and defendant chose to advance a mitigation-based leniency argument to the exclusion of all others. Indeed, the record
But
shows
counsel,
defense.
excuse me, wasn't his attorney ineffective for failing to raise this claim regarding permissive, regarding the change in the law?
Sure. No, Your Honor, and the reason why is because, as this court's well aware, Strickland's analysis regards to prejudice in this context is evidence-based and result-orientated. And so the people certainly agree that in 2023, counsel misrepresented that mandatory consecutive sentencing applied. In the 2024 proceedings, counsel directly informed the court, I confess error on this issue, that was incorrect and that was wrong. So in 2024, any taint that may have existed as a result of counsel misrepresenting the applicability of mandatory consecutive sentencing in 2023 was wiped clean. And certainly the cases that counsel cites regarding other defense counsels are ineffective, that's because they persisted in a mistaken belief that they couldn't file a motion because it was, barred by res judicata, or they thought the circumstances of their case prevented them from doing so. That's not what we have here. Counsel, after having further reviewed the issue, represented to the court that there was an error, and he asked, I cannot proceed on this motion. I'd like to speak with my client about this issue. And I think this is a nuanced point, but I would respectfully reject my friend on the other side's representation about what counsel said he was going to do upon seeking the continuance. He did not say that he was going to file an amended motion. He was going to speak with his client about it and determine whether one was necessary, which is why at the subsequent date, when the trial court initially sort of laid out the procedural posture of the case and then asked if counsel had intended to file a motion to reconsider and one was not on the record, therefore, was that because counsel did not believe one was necessary? He said, yes, Judge. So certainly that was an affirmative choice that he made, indicating that he had reviewed the issue and determined it was not one of merit. And
Mr.
certainly.
Rodriguez, may I interrupt you for a moment? And why do you, just for the sake of my question here, assume something. Assume that the state of the law is that the trial court has an affirmative duty to inform a defendant of his right to elect given the situation we have here in terms of the amendment to the sentencing statute at issue. And it is something that can't be waived by a defendant. So waiver is off the table. How does your argument proceed using that as a premise that this is not a waivable issue?
Sure. So, under your Honor's hypothetical, in the 2024 proceedings, when defense counsel informed the trial court that he had incorrectly confessed that mandatory consecutive sentencing applied, at that moment, the trial court was absolutely aware that it was entitled to exercise its discretion and consider permissive consecutive sentencing. And indeed, as the record shows, the trial court indicated to the parties, or it represented on the record to the defendant, that the parties in the court had initially erred in their belief that mandatory consecutive sentencing applied, but it then understood that permissive consecutive sentencing. So with whether defendant would have proceeded with arguing or presenting an argument in a motion to reconsider sentence premised on a lack of applicability of permissive consecutive sentencing, the trial court most certainly understood that it would have had to analyze this issue through that lens. And there's no indication in the record the court thought otherwise after being informed of defense counsel's error. So, in
Is there
regards,
anything in the record on remand in the context of what you're talking about here that indicates in any way that the trial court viewed this as a discretionary sentencing, excuse me, a discretionary consecutive sentencing issue, and then in fact it exercised its discretion in imposing a consecutive sentence?
so I'd point the court to two locations. At R65 of the record, when the court was informed or was informing defendant of this issue, the court stated directly, whereas the statute has now been changed in Illinois, when all of us started practicing law, this situation was a mandatory consecutive situation. The defendant acknowledges that statement, and the court follows up by saying, and they changed the law on us old guys, and now it's a permissive or non-mandatory. So we have to do a different type of evaluation. And the second area I would point the court to is the totality of the motion to reconsider sentencing hearing, where it is clear that the trial court was exercising its discretion. The court referenced that the fact that defendant had presented mitigation, it considered the issues, and it was very clear on the record that the court was balancing both the aggravation that had initially been presented and the arguments that counsel was making. And the arguments that counsel was making were a mitigation-based leniency argument. If defense counsel had attempted to argue against permissive consecutive sentencing, either under 5-8-4C3, which is the bond-on-bond felony situation, there would have been no merit to making that argument. It's very clear that permissive consecutive sentencing is allowed when a defendant is on bond for a felony offense and then is convicted for a second one while on bond. And that's exactly the situation we have here. And furthermore, the people argued that under 5-8-4C1, the court would have looked at permissive consecutive sentencing based on the nature and character of the defendant, the particular circumstances of the offense, and the belief that the court needed to impose a permissive consecutive sentence to protect the public from the defendant's criminal conduct. And if you look at the arguments that were presented to the court, it certainly was analyzing that issue through that lens as well. So if there had been any attempt to make an argument against permissive consecutive sentencing in regards to C1's applicability, the court would have rejected it as well. And the record shows that there would have been no legitimate basis to argue against that. So I think when you look at those two areas, the court certainly was exercising its discretion after it was clearly aware that this was an area where it had discretion and it was not mandatory consecutive sentencing. Your Honors, I'd like to address the Strickland claim for a moment. Under Strickland, defendant cannot satisfy the deficient performance prong because there is no likelihood he would have prevailed on his motion if he had included a Rule 604D claim based on how permissive consecutive sentencing did not apply to defendant's case, which is, I think, part and parcel with the argument I was just making a moment ago. As such, counsel is not deficient for failing to make a meritless argument. And in regards to prejudice, defendant cannot satisfy the prejudice prong of Strickland because the record supports the ultimate finding that a permissive consecutive sentence was necessary to protect the public from defendants' continuous criminal conduct, to vindicate respect for the law, and to deter others from engaging in similar egregious patterns of criminal conduct.
But counsel, if I could ask, weren't there mitigating factors that were presented during the sentencing hearing that if the court would have perhaps articulated some reasoning with respect to that, that I mean, wouldn't it have been possible that a permissive approach would have been taken by the court and these mitigating circumstances could have changed the outcome? That it wouldn't have been mandatory consecutive?
Are you talking about at the motion to
Second
reconsider
sentencing,
sentence?
right.
The trial court indicated, Judge, that it had considered the arguments that had been presented at the initial sentencing. And at the initial sentencing, defendant presented a mitigation-based leniency argument, a rather broad argument that he was based on his familial background and based on substance abuse history and other issues that he was asking the court to take leniency on him for this offense. And the trial court indicated that nothing it had heard, whether at the initial sentencing hearing or what was presented at the amended motion to reconsider sentencing hearing, would have changed its thought process on that. And as to that point, that shows that the court most certainly did consider at the subsequent hearing the mitigation argument the defendant had initially made. And as the record shows, it was the same argument the defense counsel raised the first time. There was nothing new there. And that's particularly because, as I argued previously, there would have been no merit to arguing against permissive consecutive sentencing either based on the bond, subsection of C3, or based on the more detailed analysis that the court would look at under C1 of the applicable statute. So, based on that, counsel made an affirmative choice to make a mitigation-based leniency argument to the exclusion of all others. And that certainly, I think, was a tactical choice given the sort of egregious nature of defendant's conduct and the facts and circumstances of the case, which didn't support, in good faith, making an argument to the contrary against permissive consecutive sentencing. Your Honors, my friend on the other side indicated during his argument that the people had forfeited any analysis of review of some of his case law, specifically Guth and Monroe. I do want to respond to that briefly. Guth and Monroe were general parenthetical citations. They were not in-depth analyses. To the extent that those analyses of those cases were not adequately developed, the people didn't forfeit anything. Moreover, as this court's well aware, forfeiture is a limitation on the parties and not the court. This court's more than capable of reviewing Monroe and Guth and seeing if they have any applicability to this case. But even looking at the parenthetical citations that defendant provided, they most certainly don't. In Monroe, defense counsel mistakenly believed that he couldn't file a motion to reconsider sentence, thus rebutting Rule 604D's certification required to make all necessary amendments. Unlike Monroe, defense counsel here didn't persist under a mistaken belief regarding the applicability of mandatory consecutive sentencing or that he couldn't file a motion to reconsider sentence. Counsel brought the issue to the court's attention, asked for time to discuss the issue with his client, and to possibly file any amended motion to reconsider if necessary. And he ultimately affirmatively represented to the court at that future court date that he did not intend to file one and one was not necessary. Furthermore, in Guth, as the parenthetical cite indicates, that case was remanded for further Rule 604D compliance, where defense counsel erroneously believed he could not file a motion to reconsider sentence based on res judicata resulting from a previously filed motion. Once again, an erroneous belief that defense counsel cannot file a motion to reconsider is different than counsel here affirmatively representing to the trial court that he determined a new motion was not necessary. So I certainly don't believe that either Monroe or Guth are applicable to this case, since those deal with counsels who persisted in an erroneous belief, and whereas counsel here not only brought to the court's attention that he had reviewed the issue, but ultimately indicated he did not believe one was necessary.
Counsel, I'd like to go back for a minute just to be sure I understand your argument. Are you contending today that the trial court imposed a discretionary consecutive sentence? You talked about the arguments that counsel made, the court was aware of that. And Is that what you're referring to in the record to have us follow your argument and conclude that this trial court did impose, use its discretion to impose a consecutive sentence?
Your Honor, my argument is that I think the record ultimate finding that a permissive consecutive sentence would have been applicable when applied in this case. Certainly, the trial court did not make any definitive statement saying I am imposing a permissive consecutive sentence. But based on the case other people cited, the trial court's not required to make that sort of definitive pronouncement. It is required to show, based on the record's totality, that a permissive consecutive sentence would have been appropriate. And if the trial court abuses discretion in that regard, in not applying one, or if the record did not support the application of a permissive consecutive sentence, then that would be an abuse of discretion. And so in this case, as to my argument, it was that based on the record's totality, it's clear that the trial court would have believed, or the record supports, that a permissive consecutive sentence was allowed in this case. And then the trial court certainly did analyze issues under the very, well-trodden lenses of discretion and balancing factors and referencing the factors it had considered its previous arguments during the initial sentencing, and why nothing it had been presented with at that future motion to reconsider hearing date modified or made the court change its opinion in any way. Your Honor,
Thank
with
you
the
for the
time I have,
clarification. Go ahead.
thank you. With the time I have left, I would like to address issue two. The trial court properly exercised its discretion in sentencing defendant to 10 years imprisonment for aggravated driving while license revoked. In this case, the record establishes that the trial court exercised appropriate discretion in sentencing defendant to 10 years imprisonment after weighing the relevant factors in aggravation and mitigation, and finding that defendant's longstanding disregard for the law, considered in conjunction with the need to deter others from engaging in similar egregious patterns of continuous criminal conduct, warranted imposing a 10-year sentence. Part of the trial court's consideration as to the seriousness of the offense was the fact that the defendant was a prolific recidivist with approximately 31 years of criminal history behind him. The trial court, contrary to defendant's arguments, absolutely and explicitly stated it considered factors in mitigation, which included the nonviolent nature of the offense, as well as defendant's familial relationships and the rehabilitative steps he had taken while in pretrial detention. It indicated that it had considered those both at the time of initial sentencing and later during the motion to reconsider sentence. And that's at pages R38 and 39 and 75 of the record. Just because defendant presented mitigation does not mean that the trial court needed to accord it the same weight as the factors in aggravation. Defendant's argument plainly seeks to have this court usurp the trial court's exercise of its discretion and ask this court to reweight the factors. I would suggest that this court should reject that call. Moreover, in regards to counsel's argument about Allen, and again, reference that the people forfeit any argument on that point. The people didn't engage with Allen because it was simply irrelevant to the circumstances of this case. As defendant points out, and the people don't disagree, the issue in Allen involved a burglary offense for stealing two packs of cigarettes, a circumstance which the appellate court characterized as trivial. Here, in contrast, the trial court did not comment or was not analyzing the end result of defendant's actions, just the mere fact of driving while his license was revoked, but rather on his prolific recidivism and how that spoke to the factors in aggravation regarding defendant's criminal history and the need for deterrence. As indicated in the PSI, defendant was 63 years old. However, his numerous convictions and sentences to incarceration had done nothing to modify his criminal behavior or propensity to commit the offense of driving while license revoked. Nothing about defendant's criminal history or the circumstances of this case are trivial. In the factual basis supporting the guilty plea, it was stipulated too that defendant had been speeding and was under the influence of alcohol while he was driving, or excuse me, he had been speeding at the time. And in the PSI, defendant admitted that he was under the influence of alcohol during his commission of the offense. And defendant repeatedly acknowledges that he disregarded the law multiple times throughout his entire life. 31 years, I think, is the number supported by the PSI. So there's nothing trivial about what occurred here. Defendant is a habitual reoffender, and the court was absolutely entitled to consider that significant factor when fashioning its sentence. The arguments that my friend on the other side makes are unavailing. They simply seek to have this court reconsider the factors in aggravation and mitigation. It is for the trial court to make that determination because of its unique ability to consider the totality of all of the evidence here and how it speaks to the issues that the court found were important and how it balanced and weighed those factors. Therefore, Your Honors, for the reasons we argue today, as well as those in our brief, we'd ask you decline, remand, and otherwise affirm defendant's conviction and sentence, unless the court has any other questions.
I don't see any other questions, Mr. Rodriguez. Thank you.
Thank you,
Mr.
Your
Daniels, rebuttal argument.
Yes, thank you, Your Honor. What I plan on doing is addressing three points regarding issue one. If the court has any questions regarding issue two, I'll be happy to answer those too. So regarding issue one, beginning with the 604D noncompliance, the state contends that the amendment here wasn't necessary because counsel took a date to make the amendment and then told the court on the next court date, I'm not going to include this. What the state overlooks is later at that same court date during the hearing, the plea counsel still brings up the mandatory consecutive sentencing issue. So this isn't a situation where counsel really thought it was truly unnecessary. What happens is what happened here instead was that counsel didn't actually do his diligence to develop that motion or that claim by amending it. The motion to include it and discussing it in a fulsome manner at the hearing. Turning to the ineffective assistance claims, I'm not hearing anything from the state disputing that there was deficient performance regarding the 2023 sentencing by misapprehending the law. And that's consistent with our position that counsel should have known better because the law had changed and he's required to know the law. And there seems to be no dispute that both the parties misunderstood it, including counsel. Now, as far as the 2024 remand proceedings, the deficient performance prong here is satisfied because had counsel actually made that amendment, included the motion, he would have won at the motion to reconsider sentencing hearing. The trial court pretty much telegraphed that when he said what he said in granting the continuance. I know that the state's quoted a couple of lines from the court's remarks during that continuance request. What got overlooked is what the trial court said just moments earlier when he was explaining to Mr. Braxton what was going on and why he was granting this continuance. And what the trial court said was, so we treated it as these two cases had to be dealt with consecutively, or yes, consecutively. One had to run after the other, so they were stacked on top of one another. That's the judge saying that I imposed a mandatory consecutive sentence here. And layer that on top of the fact that there was no admonishment made about the right to elect. All counsel had to do on remand was just put that into the motion and actually develop it at arguments. He would have won that. And as far as the Strickland prejudice, what the state does not address in argument is our point about Mescal, that it stands for the proposition that where a defense counsel's misapprehension of the consecutive sentencing law results in the trial court imposing a sentence where the judge doesn't exercise any discretion, that satisfies Strickland prejudice. And in fact, the state pretty much concedes as much in its brief at pages 25 and 26 when it addresses Mescal. When it's the subtext of what it's saying is that if this court finds that there really was a mandatory consecutive sentence imposed, we lose on prejudice. And that's precisely the case here. And we know that because those are the words that came out of the judge's mouth on remand. So because there was Strickland prejudice here, Mr. Braxton has satisfied ineffective assistance for either of those two claims, and that allows him to be entitled to remand for further post-plea proceedings. And if there aren't any other questions from the courts, we would ask that this court reverse and remand for the reasons that we've discussed today at arguments, as well as for the reasons that we've set forth in our briefs.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Daniels. Thank you, counsel. The court will take the case under advisement and will issue a written decision.